stay standing for a moment. What I'd like you to do is just close your eyes and be really still and centre yourself. Find that inner core again and just be quiet there for just 10, 20 seconds. Appreciate the invitation to spend some time. I'm thankful that you're willing to listen. I don't know many of you. I'm relatively new to the movement. Been a gateway for about 3 years and loving it. And involved in the work of leadership health. And so just to give you a bit of background for those who don't know me, for the last 10 years, I've had the absolute joy and privilege of working in with four and in two organisations on the mainland. One is Australian College of Ministries. I'm very aware that Alpha Crucis is our sponsor, and go Alpha Crucis. I'm absolutely for theological education if that's what God calls you to do. It's a wonderful thing. And I had the privilege of working 8 years of the last 10 as Associate Dean. And that was working with about 100 students for training for ministry every year and watching and coaching them in their spiritual maturity. Also worked part-time for Churches of Christ in New South Wales in that organisation with their senior leaders and chaplains, again, enriching and enlivening and invigorating their spiritual walk. And it's really from those two roles that I'm drawing today. You're getting the harvest, if you like, of everything I've seen and heard in working as a Christian leader in at work. So I want to share with you three things, and I could share more, but just three things this morning that are life changers, game changers for you as a Christian leader. These are not lightweight things. These are things that if you take this up today, even one of them, they're going to change your entire way of living. But they will be an enabler for you to finish the marathon of Christian ministry. And here they are. I don't know if you can... we've got the thing working yet. No, that's the wrong... that's not me.
No.
Sorry. So here they are. I'll tell you, they'll come up on the board eventually. They're transitions, and I've watched leaders make these transitions and not make these transitions. And when leaders don't make these transitions, it is not pretty. It is painful and ugly. So the first one is, and this is to do with our inner identity source, where we get our sense of self from. It's a movement from performance to a movement of finding our source and our security in the felt love of God. And I've used that word felt on purpose. And I want to unpack that with you a bit more this morning. The second one is an energy transfer. The leaders that last and show resilience are leaders that have moved from being a canal to a reservoir. And I want to unpack that for you in detail. And then thirdly, leaders who have made a change of lifestyle from being busy and burnt out to a leader who lives a lifestyle of rhythmic, restful practices. So that's the three. The first one you could sum up by asking the question, do you feel loved? Do you actually feel loved by God? Not theoretically or theologically, but do you walk every day and even every hour in the felt experience of being loved by God? The second question I want to ask you that goes with the reservoir and the canal one is, do you feel spiritually full? And the third question that goes with the third one, busy, burnt out, or rhythmic and restful, is, do you feel rested and unhurried in your leadership and in your ministry? Okay, let's talk about the first one. USB is in my amp, excuse me. That's a terrible thing to give someone a woman's handbag and go, find the USB in the handbag. She'll have fun in there, I tell you. Might take her 2 weeks. Alrighty, let's go with this first one. Okay. What's this felt experience of the love of God? When's the last time you have really felt the love of God? Because I know that pastors and leaders and people in ministry can preach the best sermons on the love of God. Really convincing, strongly theological, but it's all just theory. And when I sit with them and I ask them, when's the last time that you actually felt the love of God? They scratch their head and go, well, I felt it when I became a Christian and I had a bit of when I was baptised, and maybe 5 years ago I had a powerful experience. But what about last week? Or yesterday? Because this felt experience of the love of God is not just a nice idea we talk about, but it's going to be the renewable sustenance for your soul for the rest of your leadership walk. And I've discovered, as I've read tons of essays from students who are studying for theological degrees, when it comes to what's really happening in the heart, they tell me they don't really believe that God is that loving, because look what happened to my ministry. It crashed. And look what happened. My wife got cancer. And I discover, when you push in, that their actual ideas about God are rather screwed up. And while they're in the pulpit preaching God's love, inside, in the covets of their own inner heart, they're actually not sure about how God really is. And that's part of the reason why I do some spiritual coaching, to flush out these false ideas we harbour about the unkind God. And yet we're so fervent in ministry to this unkind kind of idea of God. So what happens there? Well, I want to tell you about the first time I ever went to see a spiritual coach, a spiritual mentor. She was actually called a spiritual director, if you're familiar with that terminology. And I was found this lady called Lorraine in Launceston, and I thought, well, rightio, I'll give this a go. And I rang her up. That's what she did. And I sat down and I said, I want you to coach me in my spiritual maturity. Would you do that? And she said, sure, that's what I do. So she said, tell me a little bit about your spiritual ministry. So I told her, and I was doing this. This is about when I was about 32. This is like decades ago, decades and decades. I was racing around doing a lot of things, and I was telling her about them, and she said, man, I'm puffed, she said, listening to you. You are working so hard. I said, well, yeah, I am. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Aren't we just supposed to power on and do as much? Because there's a whole world out there to save. And she said, wow. She said, do you know, if you just stay in that chair, in that armchair you're sitting in for the rest of your life, God will still love you the same. And everything inside me revolted when she said that. That cannot possibly be true, I thought. There's no way God would be so disappointed if I didn't do all these things I was doing. And what she did over the course of the next few years is flush out of me a performance-based way of ministering. It was all about what I was doing for God. And she began to teach me about, I saw in her a love that God was giving her that I knew nothing about as an evangelical Christian. I preached it, I knew it, but I didn't really feel it. And so she led me to start to see that, like Jesus, when he was baptized and the Spirit of God came upon him and said, "You are my son, whom I love. I am so pleased with you." That was actually said to Jesus well before he did one thing, really, in his ministry life. So love comes, the felt love of God comes, not because we are working hard, but just because it is. And we need to make this shift from performing for God to just knowing that we are so deeply loved by God. Trouble is, when we've been operating in a performance-based mentality, what's happened is the ego, your sneaky, slithery little ego, comes in and parasites itself to your spiritual ministry. Did you know that? And you start looking sideways and saying, "Well, I'm doing really good, better than that one, and better than that one." And we start to get very clutchy about the roles we have, because our whole identity is centred in the role. And when a new person comes along to the church that looks a whole lot better than you, that acts a whole lot more spiritual than you, that can preach a whole lot better than you or play an instrument a whole lot better than you, our whole ego starts to shudder, because ego hates diminishment. Ego screams when you take away control. And we begin to operate our own little kingdom on the side of building God's kingdom. And so we need to really become friends with our ego in ministry and make a shift from building our own sense of performance and it's what I do and how well I do it, to the sole source of who I am comes down to the fact that God absolutely loves me, and I feel it every day. So pray for the revelation of increased felt sense of the love of God. I spoke to a leader just last year, and she said, "You know, I'm leading an enormous youth group, but that thing you talk about, that felt love of God, I just don't have that." And I said, "Why don't you just go outside? I want you to go outside and spend some time with God." She went outside. I could see her through the glass. And she was praying that God had come. And the next thing I looked down, and it was a dull day just like this, and there was an almighty sunbeam that had descended upon her, just where she was. And I thought, "Oh, look at that." And then she came in later and she said, "You know what? I had never felt the love of God that descended when that sunbeam descended right on me." Pray for experience like that, that will leave you with a whole bank of knowledge that God loves you and douses you with love, if you have the eyes to see it and the spiritual tentacles to feel it on a regular basis. The second thing I want to share with you, that's a big shift, the shift from performance to a reliance on the deep love of God for you. And the leaders who make that, and sometimes it takes you 5 to 10 years to make that transition. And sometimes you're only forced into making that transition by a leadership failure, by getting wounded because you get pushed out of your role, and you have to then go and find your sense of identity somewhere else than role. But that's when wounding and failure and diminishment becomes your best friend in life. Because when we're moving downward, we're actually moving upward in spiritual life. The second thing is reservoirs and canals. Okay, so Saint Bernard of Clairvaux. Here we go. I don't know if you can see that. You might have to stand up to see this, but this is important to follow. St. Bernard was a 12th century reformer, and he said this thing. So these words are actually spoken to the church 900 years ago, and they're just as true today. Listen to this. The one who is wise, therefore, will live as more like a reservoir than a canal. The canal simultaneously pours out what it receives. Get that? The reservoir retains water till it's filled and then offers the overflow without loss to itself. He said, today there are many in the church who act like canals. They just transfer energy from one place to the other. The reservoirs are far too rare. Canals want to pour this stream forth before they've been filled. They are more ready to speak than to listen. Is this you? They are impatient to teach what they have not yet grasped, and they are full of presumption to govern others while they know not yet how to govern themselves. They are really serious words. The beautiful thing about a reservoir is that it gives from the spill. You get that? Imagine living so spiritually full every day that your ministry is just the spill. That's how to do it. The question is then, how do you build your reservoir? Because a reservoir needs fullness and depth to spill. Your spiritual formation, your journey of transformation into the likeness of Christ is what your reservoir is. And so we need to be spending some time and giving attention to your transformative work. You can't do anything to build your sanctification, by the way. Did you know that? It's not about trying harder to be holy. Good luck with that, I'll tell you. It is actually about developing the postures of surrender that welcome God in, and then he can do the transfiguration of your ghastly personality just like mine. And so what do we do? Because spiritual formation is a big work. It's actually the main work for you to do with God. And so reservoirs, as I said, have depth. And the trouble with you and I and our culture and our way of living today is that we love to live a jet ski experience. We jet ski across everything. It is kind of fun to move fast, but after a while you realise you don't even know what's underneath that water. So I want to ask you, why don't we step out of the jet ski? I'd love a jet ski, by the way, but anyway. Why don't we step out of the jet ski and put in our deep sea diving equipment and start to work and live for a life of depth? Sure. Richard Foster said this: superficiality is the curse of our age. The doctrine of instant satisfaction is a primary problem. The desperate need today is not for a greater number of intelligent Christians or gifted Christians, but for deep Christians. And the classical disciplines, and I'm going to give you a few of those at the end, of the spiritual life call us to move from surface living into the depths. They invite us to explore the inner caverns of the spiritual realm. They urge us to be the answer to a hollow world. And the quote goes on. Be a deep sea diver. Do the work. Have a friend who's been doing a lot of deep spiritual work over the years. But her partner is not. When she recently booked him into a psychiatric institution, I called her to see how she was doing, and she said in tears, "We've got to do the work. If we don't do the work, the inner work, it does not go well with our soul." And we have so many issues with mental health today. We need to do our inner work. And it's an inner work that goes on, mind you, our whole lifetime. One of the things I saw some research on recently was the best thing young parents can do in preparation for the raising of their children is to actually tell their story, tell their life story to someone else, and to work on their life story from what it was like when they were a kid. Because if you can actually articulate and formulate and process what happens to you from when you can remember you're alive to where you are then, and process that, that equips you for good parenting and for secure relationship more than anything else. And that's the work of spiritual formation, is working out where God has been in your life and processing the pain of some of that. I've got a slide there. Henry Nouwen is, I don't know if you've heard of him, he's a great spiritual writer and a wonderful guy. And he says that spiritual formation, our maturity, our depth, will come as we grapple with these tensions in our life. It's the tension between the true self and the false self, between what's really you and God and the falsity that we manufacture to make ourselves look good. That our spiritual maturity lies in the crevice of between self-care and when we care for others, and the challenges as a pastor and a leader of managing those two things. Our spiritual maturity lies in the crevice, if you like, between the challenge between needing to spend time alone and needing to be with people, and the challenge between being healed and wanting to be healed and being still wounded. And the call to, do we go and pray or do we go and be with what's happening? And the call between, do we be compassionate with our young leader who needs to be pulled in line, or do we confront? And these are really, or is God absent or is he really present? These are really hard tensions to hold, and they fill our lives with. And as we grapple with these, this is how we mature in our spiritual life. It's the formation. When I was asked to go and take up this role at ACOM, Australian College of Ministries, 10 years ago, I knew God had called me to it, and it was quite scary, as I'm not really an academic. They chose me because of my practical experience rather than my I have academic degrees, but. A pracademic is what they call them, and I was terrified going into the academic world and interviewed by these suited men with all their scary, you know. And to be given the role of looking after between 70 to up to 150 students each year and being responsible for their spiritual development was more than overwhelming. And at the time I was reading a book by Saint Therese of Lisieux, a French nun who died about 100 years ago. She wrote a book called The Story of the Soul. And I saw a prayer she prayed, because she at 20 was invited into a similar role. And she prayed this prayer, and I'm going to share it with you. It's my paraphrase, because her words were fancy and a little complicated and French. So I'm going to share my paraphrase, because this is what my whole prayer for the last 10 years, and I offer it to you. And here's how it goes. Draw me, God, because in drawing me, draw all others that come along with me. Like a mighty river pulls with it the stuff that it collects and goes downstream and goes out into the ocean. Pull all others with me. See, what that prayer says is that my relationship with God, that's my total focus. And the rest, if I turn around and try and orchestrate and physically manage all their lives, I'll be dead within the first week. But if my focus is just, God, if you draw me, all the rest will come along. Can you pray that in your ministry? This means a fundamental shift in the way we operate our week. That God needs the first fruits of our time. And it's not just a 10-minute quick prayer and Bible reading. It's big chunks of time to develop depth. How do you develop depth? You keep digging in the same spot. You've tried to dig a hole and keeps falling back in, and you've got to keep shoveling it out. And enough reference has been made this morning to our compulsive changing. We keep changing. We keep, you know, we don't just read one book and really devour it. We read 100 books, that's me, and, you know, sort of jet ski across the top. How do you keep your reservoir filled? Very important. We keep it filled with contributories. So when I first came across this quote, I don't know, 5-10 years ago, the one about the reservoir and the canal, I researched Victorian reservoirs. How is it that 5.5 million Melbourneites can turn on the tap every morning for a shower and brush their teeth and turn the dishwasher on and and run the laundry and there's enough water for 5 million people at once? How's that ever happened? It's happened because 100 years ago, some very clever men and visionary men thought, we need to fix this. And so they developed about 10 enormous reservoirs that lay up in the mountains of northern Victoria. And what you don't know is that underground there are enormous pipes that pipe all the water down. And it goes through various stages. And one of the most interesting things I discovered was that those, I don't know how, I can't even say how many billion litres of water are sitting up there. But there are some reservoirs that are shut off because the water has to rest for up to 5 years before it's ever used. Yeah. Imagine that. Because of what needs to break down in the process. And what I want to say to you is what's already been echoed today, don't be a canal that just gets a good idea and, you know, 5 minutes later it's in your sermon. Rest what you learn in your spiritual life. Let it rest for years before. So it's broken down enough for you to consume and to move out into your fingertips. Every cell of your body has to live what you teach. Otherwise, you'll just be a canal. And if you want to dilly-dally around in the shallows, well, go for it. But we have to have people of depth. So there are contributories that you need to arrange in your life so that your reservoir remains full. Contributories are things like spiritual practices that keep you full. And again, they're not lightweight 5-minute things. These have got to be built in to your day and week and year and month, and we'll come to that in a minute. There's got to be renewal times, there's got to be development times, there's got to be rest time, and there's got to be a lot of learning time and reading time, and more than anything else, you have to spend large chunks of time with God. And so now I want to move to the third point. And I want to ask you, when I finish this third point, to come up with one thing that you want to change, one of these that you want to take home and implement in your life. So we're going to have a little discussion around the table, maybe just with three, in a moment when I finish this last point. I want you to be ready to say, here's the thing that's touched my heart today. Here's the thing I want to change. So here's the third one. So remember we had transitioning, the first one was transitioning from performance and actually developing that foundation of your whole life, soul, heart and mind on the felt experience of the love of God. The second one was moving from being a canal mover to a reservoir and doing what it takes to actually fill, and then ministry becomes the spillover. And the third one is developing a lifestyle of moving from a busy, burnt out pace, just surviving, to a rhythmic and restful lifestyle. This is a lifestyle that's actually going to require some disengagement, not just full-on engagement. We have idealised busyness. Mm-hmm. I notice when we greet each other on a Sunday morning, the first thing we say to each other is, you been busy? Like, that's really good. Been busy? Yep, flat out. You know how that goes? And we kind of like, somehow that seems to Somehow, if we're flat out and we're busy, we seem to feel so much better about ourselves. Well, secretly, we think if we're not busy, we're not important. If we're not busy, we haven't quite made the grade, we're not wanted yet. And we deceive ourselves into thinking that busy is far more important than not busy. Do you know busyness is a single thing that rapes the connection between you and your children? Busyness is the thing that rapes your relationship with your partner and with your congregation. We've lost the art, you see, in our busyness of encountering our own selves. And that's one of the reasons why we become so busy. We end up living in a tomb of our own being. I love these words. These are not on the screen. John O'Donohue, single guy, the writer that's influenced my life than anybody else. He says this: deep down, you hunger to meet your soul. All day long, through the course of your life or our lives, we struggle to catch up with ourselves. Know that feeling? No? You're all really good at this. I tell you, we are so taken up with life, so busy, so distracted that we cannot dedicate enough time or recognition to the depths within ourselves. We endeavour to see ourselves and meet ourselves, and yet there's such complexity within us and so many layers to the human heart that we rarely ever encounter ourselves. So we need a good theology of rest, just like Jesus did. You see, when he gathered his disciples in those last moments in Matthew 28, he said, "Go out and make disciples in all the nations." You know these words. This is in the Voice translation. "Ceremoniously wash them through baptism in the name of the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit." And then he said, "Disciple them." But this is the bit I love. This is our instruction how to disciple. "Form in them the practices and the postures that I've shown you." If you were a disciple, I wonder, sitting there that day, you would think back over what Jesus had done, how he practiced his life. Do you know one of the most important things that the gospel says is that Jesus had a practice of going up while it was still dark to be with the Father, so he had the direction for the day. Jesus had practices of rest. When the line was long and he was healing people, there was times, and the gospels say, that he just turned and he went. He said, "I'm done. I'm done. The Father is saying, let's go to the hills." That's a practice of rest. You see, if it's up to our performance mentality, we would want to heal them all. You know, that would be, we think, what God would require. But there are times to stop. You see, we need to develop rhythms, daily rhythms, weekly rhythms. And in those days and those weeks and those months and those years, we fill them with practices. Now, a spiritual practice, and some of you may know this as a spiritual discipline, that word. Spiritual disciplines are windows that we open in our life that let in the fresh air of God, that let in that brand new daily experience of being loved, the felt experience of being loved. There's all sorts of rhythms, and if you don't put them in there, they're never going to wander into your rhythm, into your week by themselves. You have to put them in. And so weekly rhythms, a sabbatical rhythm in the sense of, do you have a day off a week? And for a Christian leader, it cannot be Sunday. It's our work day, right? And if you can manage to get 2 days off, you know, health-wise, you need 2 days off together to really flourish. So your adrenaline could dip down further enough to make, you know, good, and then up again to work. So if you can't get 2 days a week, if you're only surviving on, if you're surviving on no days a week for rest, well, it's good luck to you. You won't last long. So Abraham Heschel, a Jewish rabbi that I love to read, he wrote a wonderful book on rest called The Sabbath. It's a classic, and if you like Hebrew-type stuff, Jewish stuff than get Abraham Heschel. He says that in the Hebrew scheme of things, that the Sabbath is really, you know, to do Sabbath well, to rest well, you've got to go 3 days of work getting ready for the Sabbath. So Sabbath is really queen of the week, 3 days preparing for the Sabbath. Then have Sabbath, a day of rest, and then the 3 days that follow it are actually savouring how good the rest was. And then you go again, 3 days preparation for Sabbath, because you can't have a good day off unless you prepare for it.
Yeah.
Wow. So do that, queen of the days. You know what we do? We go hard for sometimes 6 days, and then we crash on the seventh on the couch and we're useless. And one of the most important thing about the Sabbath or your day with God is that we need to rest from even the thought of work. We need to play as if we were in heaven where work doesn't even exist. You need to have fun with God on that day. Discover the playful God. That's what we need to do. And Abraham Heschel said, when we slow down and we cease our restless activity, we realise that nothing we do actually impresses God. Gee, that's a bitter pill to swallow. Nothing we do actually impresses God. And I think that's a whole reason for Sabbath, so that we can realign that it's all about Him and not about work. And that goes for spiritual ministry as well. Okay, so we need quarterly and monthly rhythms, and we need yearly rhythms. So you need to have built into your life spiritual retreats, silent retreats, spiritual renewal times. I bet you're freaking out right now and going, you just don't know my calendar, because I can't even fit in what I have to do, let alone you loading all this onto me. It requires a complete renovation of your life. But if you don't, you will not last the distance. I had a minister come to me in one of my groups that I lead up in Sydney, and we were talking about restful rhythms. And I said to him, how long since you had annual leave? And he goes, I don't take annual leave. I go, what? What do you mean you don't take annual leave? He said, I haven't had a holiday in years. Why not? I said. He said, because every time I leave, go away for a week or 2 weeks, my congregation play up. I'm not sure how true that was, actually, you know. I actually wonder whether it was more, if I leave, someone might replace me, or someone might do a better job than me, and that might be seen. And I might discover that I'm actually, what's that word? Redundant. Anyway, I said to him, I want you to go home and I want you to book 4 weeks annual leave with your wife and go away. Do you know he didn't? And 6 weeks later, he was in the hospital with a major heart attack. And today he's out of ministry completely. It doesn't end pretty when we don't put restful rhythms in. And what about a sabbatical? A sabbatical is a rest for your leader after 7 or 10 years, when that time is not really annual leave and you don't really go to Queensland, Gold Coast on your sabbatical, but you design it to go away and to be totally revived and revamped and re-energised on a deep spiritual level. So how do you do all this? Well, I've been sharing some of this with our Gateway people, and you get your yearly calendar out. This is the only way to do it. You get your big yearly calendar out, one you can plot in, and you put, this is what I do every year, and it works a treat, and I can say that my reservoir is full because of this practice. Put in the annual leave first. There it is, locked in. Nothing changes. It does not shift for anything. And then you put in the spiritual renewal times through the year. It might just be 2 or 3 days here and 2 or 3 days there. It's all in the calendar. I put in my regular coaching appointment every month. Nothing changes. No other appointment ever shifts that, because that's the highlight of my month. That's the hour, and I wish I had 10 hours, but I only get 1 hour with my coach, my spiritual director, every month, and she listens with God to my life. Not my work, but my inner life, to see where God is moving in my heart. and life. And so then work goes around all that stuff. You see, what we do is we just put work in first. So you've got to lock these things in. So, okay, I want to just say a couple of other things. Love Alan Fadling's new book. If it's not quite available in Australia yet, we need to move, he said, from hyperactivity of spiritual adolescence into a fruitful and unhurried work. Just a quick word on high and low GI practices. You know, in our diet, we have high GI food and we have low GI food. A high GI, high glycemic index is when something has a lot of quick calories, you know, the sugar hit. You know that? The Mars bar. And then a low GI is something like broccoli. It does not give you a hit when you eat it. At least it doesn't for me. But when I eat it, I know, and I don't really like broccoli, but I eat it regularly because I know that that practice will mean disease keeps from my door, hopefully. In our Christian way of events and our way of living, we have developed a lot of high GI stuff. The big sugar hit, the quick fix, but we need to move to low GI. And I'm going to give you three broccoli practices now. You are not going to enjoy these, but I tell you, they will save your soul. You ready for them? The first one is solitude. Mark 1:35. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went to a solitary place where he prayed. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, some of you might know him. Oh, sorry, not personally, but know of him. He said this in our solitude. We are so afraid of silence that we chase ourselves from one event to the next in order not to have to spend one moment alone with ourselves. In order not to look at ourselves in the mirror. Because solitude shows us who we are. Thomas A. Kempis, I think we've got that slide. He said, unless you like solitude, it is not safe for you to appear in public. Do you like that? Have you ever been with someone and you're like, man, it takes so much just to be with that person. Oh, they're energy draining. It would be better that they would go and spend a day by themselves to defrag than actually be in your space. And dare anybody think the same about us? So in solitude, when we're by ourselves, we unmask the false self that that false self so much wants to be admired, and we have to sit by ourselves and there's no one to admire us. That's the best work for your soul to do. Silence is the next broccoli practice. Silence for the tongue is like rehab for the addict. Silence purifies our soul. We become addicted to noise because noise, again, protects us from confronting our stark deeps of ourselves. We don't even know what's swimming around in that, you know, reservoir sometimes, you know, ourselves. You know, we're too afraid to wonder what's in there. Silence is a discipline where we put all that away to regenerate. I spent 8 days once on a silent retreat. It was the best, it was the worst experience and the best experience. And what I noticed is that when I came out of that 8 days, and Brett picked me up, my husband picked me up from the airport, and for those of you who know Brett, going from silence to... Sorry. Because he's a talker. That was violence. Sorry, Brett. But what I realised is that when you've been in silence, you realise the purity that you can actually... And it was like the veranda... I felt like a house where the verandas were all cleared And it was a welcoming space for others to come so I could really hear them. And I realised that most of us live like a crowded house, untidy and cluttered with stuff, and we barely have the capacity to hear anybody even on our doorstep, let alone inviting people into our being so we can have this deep presence that was mentioned before. And the last one is stillness. These three go together. Silence, if you can do them at once, it's great. Silence, solitude and stillness. And do them in chunks, large chunks. I'm not talking about 5 minutes. I'm talking about building up to so you can spend whole half days and whole days and then weekends. And if you're really into it, you can go away and do an 8-day silent retreat. I have friends that have done 30-day silent retreats. So stillness. Here's Blaise Pascal. He said all human evil comes from a single cause: man's inability to sit still in a room. Think about that one for a while. What stillness does, as opposed to energy and as opposed to activity, and I'm not against activity, of course. These are the inbuilt energizers of the other. Stillness, we unify. All our fragmented, fractured parts of ourself have time to be collected, remembered, rescued, and integrated into ourself. We have time in stillness to feel. And when we allow time to feel, we can grieve, we can feel joy, and we can allow ourselves to become really healthy emotionally. And in stillness, God's presence creeps in like a tide, and we feel God's presence in ways that's impossible to feel when you're on the road hurtling to your next destination. Peace is the fruit of stillness. You know, there's that story in the Gospels where Jesus has the demoniac, it's a legion, and he has 1,000 demons in him. And after Jesus has been with him, he's sitting peacefully. I often use that story for myself. There are 1,000 of myselfs. We're a whole committee. We're a whole tribe in there. And everybody wants a different part of us. And if we can just sit still and allow the recollection of ourself, this is a great answer to mental health and anxiety that plagues us today. Okay, coming to a close. Here we go. Let your teaching emerge from silence, as Jesus did. Let your team building emerge from solitude, as Jesus did. And let your activity emerge from stillness, as Jesus practiced. These three are the cradle of your communion with God. On top of that, find yourself a great coach. I haven't got time to talk about that, but I want to come back to these things. I want you to spend just 5 minutes, and there'll be three of you, and if you can just form yourselves into three people close by, what is one thing that you feel you want to do, an action point, an input, something that you want to put in practice from what I've shared this morning? Let me give you 5 minutes to do that, and then I'll come back. Okay, if I could just call your attention back here for a moment. If we could have some silence, that would be helpful. And if you could... I just want to... that's good. Thanks. Sorry to pull you out of the engagement. But I just want to pray for you before I hand back to Gus, or David, sorry. Is it David or Gus? You, okay. Let's just pray together, will we? Thank you, Lord, for sending your lightning strikes into our minds and hearts this morning about things that need to change. Lord, our desire is there, but God, send your empowerment for us to do this. Hound us with your spirit until we make these surrender to you. Lord, I pray for every single person here. May your Holy Spirit shine and descend upon them in these places that we've talked about this morning. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.